Welcome back, everybody. Another edition of Two Man Advantage, the podcast. And as always, joined by my good friend, Pierre LeBrun in Toronto. And today, an extra special guest, we have Dave Tippett, longtime NHL coach and now the senior advisor for Seattle Hockey Partners, LLC. Dave, I had to look that up. I couldn't memorize that. I'm actually reading from the computer here. Now, is that on a business card of yours, or do you have to remind yourself of your new title?
Actually, you know what? This is the first time, I think, in 35 years I've had a business card, and it just says Dave Tippett on it. It doesn't have anything else on it other than a phone number and an address. So, to be determined, I guess.
Well, that means you get to write in whatever you want, depending on the crowd you're with or
talking to. Exactly.
Well, but hold on. That's kind of let's just go right to the jugular here, Dave Tippett. I mean, that's a good place to start. What will the job title say one day when Seattle hopefully gets its team here? I mean, I think that's a question I literally get from everyone in hockey all the time. So you have your chance right here to tell the world.
Todd Lewicki and I have been talking about a kind of a longer term commitment here. And so we're a little bit of an upper management role on the team. It won't be, we talked about coaching. He said, don't take it off the table when we came here, but I kind of feel like I've gone the other direction from that. And if I wanted to coach, I could probably be coaching already, but I'm enjoying what I'm doing. So I'm going to stay in Seattle and it'll be some kind of an executive management role within the team.
Well, there you go. We're breaking some news here on the podcast.
Breaking some news. Yeah. Well, and maybe that's a great way to move on and just explain, you know, what your role has been, because my sense is it has sort of evolved since you started working with the Seattle group. And so what exactly are you doing, Dave? Are you looking at players? Are you looking?
We haven't even hardly started on the hockey stuff yet, other than I've put together a structure, what a hockey operations would look like for them, just for budgeting and just for personnel point of view. But on the hockey side, really what we'll do is we'll get through the December 4th announcement first. That's got to come first before anybody starts moving forward. But, you know, the ideal situation is if we start in 2020, that we'll look to fill a general manager's role, you know, in late to early summer next year, and pretty much the same timeline as Vegas did with George. And, the general manager will fill out a scouting staff for the first year, and the following year we'll, you know, continue to add to the hockey operations pieces of coaching and minor league coaches and all the training staff and everything that goes with that. So my job, for the most part, to this point, is a lot of stuff to do with the buildings, the Key Arena, which we're going to redo all the hockey spaces in the Key Arena, help with the design of those, the training center that we're going to build a brand new training center here, a three-sheet training center that will house not just our main offices, but all the hockey operations offices and dressing room and facilities for the team. So I'm involved in all the planning and preparation for all those spaces also. So that takes up a big part of my time right now. And then you're just doing some due diligence on a lot of different things, watching what teams are doing, thinking about personnel that might fit within our group. And so there's a lot of little things going on every day that ends up being a pretty busy guy. And I've been doing a little bit of traveling, getting out and looking at some different buildings. I was in Chicago last week and looked at Chicago's new practice facility. I've been out to Minnesota and looked at their new facility. So just a lot of that stuff and watching a lot of hockey in between.
Well, Dave, I'm sure it'll be up to between you and whoever becomes a GM, who you're going to end up having behind the bench if it's not you. It doesn't sound like it will be.
No, that's not what the plan is right now.
Right. But what I was going to say is you have an old Hartford Whalers teammate, and you knew I was going to get here. but you have an old Hartford Whalers teammate who, after a glorious decade in Chicago, was let go on Tuesday in Joel Quenneville. And you know, I know we're putting the cart in front of the horse here, but I know you guys go back, and I just wondered if you could share your thoughts on what happened with Joel. And, I mean, we're only half kidding, but He's obviously
Bad day all the way around for all the Whalers, because it wasn't just Joel. It was three Whalers got let go yesterday. Teammates, you know, with Kevin and Alfie going. But no, you never like to see that happen to a coach. I mean, you know, I know personally what they're going through. And, you know, I never left the team in the middle of a year, which I think, you know, probably makes this thing a little more, because it just ends so suddenly. But, you know, Joel had an unbelievable run there, and his record speaks for itself, the three cups and just what he was working with there. And, you know, it just comes to a point where I think change is good for everybody. I think the change might be good for Joel, and I'm not sure what he's going to do yet, but him stepping away and maybe taking a little time probably wouldn't be bad for him. And you know, I don't know the young coach that went into Chicago there, but maybe he comes in with some fresh energy and they go. But it's sad to see a good friend like Joel go. He's a heck of a coach, and just from coaching a lot against them, there's not too many better in the game. So, but hopefully the time off for him will be good for him.
So what you're saying, sorry to interrupt, Scotty. So what you're saying is maybe Coach Quenneville should take a whole year off, I'm trying to get the timeline there. Let me see. Seattle 2020. Hold on there.
2 years. Yeah.
All right.
Who knows? We'll probably bump into each other at some point, and I'll get a better idea what he's going to do.
You've been through this, as you mentioned. It's never happened to you in the middle of the season, but last year was so unusual, because really until the very end of the regular season, I think Alain Vigneault was relieved of his duties by the Rangers after game 82 for them. And here we have two coaches, two coaching changes made within days of each other, with John Stephens, of course, going in LA, and then Joel in Chicago a few days later. And is it just do you think, Dave, in your experience, is it just a pendulum thing that these things, there's no rhyme nor reason to why, you know, maybe where you see two or three coaches go in a short period of time, and then you last year you go an entire season without seeing coach fired until the very end. Is there a pattern to it, do you think, or what's your view on that?
I don't know. It's hard to say. You know, my wife last year, she thought it was exactly what needed to happen, because she wanted me to take a year off. But now she's going, well, okay, how about a year? How about not 10 years, you know? But, you know, it's I guess there's different pressures and there's different timelines. And, you know, every team, they're independent thinkers, every team. And they you get to the point where you just say they got to make a change. But it's, you know, it's interesting, the feeling from coaches. I know when I left Dallas, I was sour because I got, you know, let go. And when I left Arizona, I left on my own accord. So it was, I was glad to walk away and get some time. So coaches take it different. And I'm sure GMs look at everything in a different light. And sometimes they feel like status quo is the best and to work through it. But then you get to other times when they said, it's a change that has to be made. So those are the downfalls of coaching right there.
Right. And Dave, I'm wondering if going back to Seattle, if you plan to be in Sea Island, Georgia, at the NHL Board of Governors meeting early next month. You know, obviously the league, the Board of Governors will finally have the big vote on Seattle by the sounds of it. And just wondering if you plan to be there.
I don't know if I'll be there or not. I haven't talked to Todd yet. I know Todd is going to be there. He's the only one that I know from our staff is going. We have, I think they've got a couple of things planned right after that in Seattle here, so I'm not sure how big our traveling party will be down there. I don't think there would be a lot to do down there other than just stand there and say, you know, the vote's gone through. But I know there's some plans for some stuff going on up here that I might have to be involved in. I haven't got that far yet with Todd.
And as a quick follow to that, Gary Bettman has mentioned, and Bill Daly several times to us in the media, that the expansion roster rules or draft rules will be largely the same, the ones that, yeah, you know, help Vegas get a bit of a head start. And on the other hand, I've had a number of GMs, some of whom that I've quoted, saying that they've kind of learned their lesson from maybe overthinking or overplaying their hand with George McPhee and the Vegas group through that process. I'm wondering you know, and these are conversations you'll have, obviously, with the new GM.
Well, we must be talking to the same people because I'm hearing the same thing.
well, that's, it's a long question here, but my point is, are you starting to formulate some ideas that you and the new GM and the new front office eventually will, you know, form into a game plan?
Yeah, well, it starts with, you know, the rules when things are, when you get the rubber stamp finally, and, you know, we'll get making sure the rules are the same and everything. But I've done a real deep study into Vegas and all the transactions they made, the players they picked and stuff. So, but I think you're exactly right. I think the GMs throughout the league will be better prepared just from the experience of going through it. And so that'll make our job maybe a little bit harder, but you know, the rules that are in place allow you to get some good players. So it's, I don't think it's like it was when, say, Minnesota and Columbus came in, where it was a long, you know, you were in for a long rebuilding process kind of thing, or building, not rebuilding, but, there's going to be good players available, and hopefully, Vegas set a pretty high bar on their first year, but hopefully we can get some good players and start out very well.
I'm curious, Dave, about you. You mentioned you've been going around to different places and looking at their physical setup, but that Vegas model must be something that gives you such a real good handle in terms of preparing and moving forward. When you, like, if you call up George McPhee, or if you call up Kelly McCrimmond or Murray Craven, who was so important for them in terms of building their practice facility and getting their infrastructure off the ground, are they happy to share with you? I mean, you guys are going to be, if all goes well, competitors and possibly, my guess is, in the same division. Do they take your calls, or what's the relationship like?
Yeah, I know. Well, it's funny. Todd Lewicki was friends with George from way back in Vancouver days, so they know each other well. I know Kelly McCrimmon very well, so there's always conversations, but they've been more than generous with their time, and it's not so much the hockey and their mindset of why they picked this player or that player. It's a lot of the infrastructure stuff, the challenges that maybe jump up at you that you don't recognize are coming, and all of a sudden there's a deadline or a challenge of getting something prepared or something that you just overlook. So they've been real. I've been talking with Kelly McCrimmon. He's been very, forthcoming, and just their challenges of the first year. And obviously they didn't have very many, but the ones they did, you just try to make sure you're preparing for all the different scenarios that are going to be thrown your way.
Very cool. David, you just last time you coached, you mentioned Arizona at the end of that 16-17 season and stepping away. Are there things that you've missed about coaching that you didn't think you would miss, or maybe there were things that you that have allowed you to sort of step further into this new career that maybe surprised you once you got away from the game? I wonder what that transition away after so long behind the bench has, if there have been parts of it that surprised you.
The part that you miss is the game, like the ability to coach against other, the coach against the other coach on the other team, like the game within the game there is the fun part. And you know, the energy and just the preparation going into the hour before the game, you're sitting there and you're in your head, you're going through how you think the matchups are going to go, what you're going to do to get away from matchups since you're on the road. I mean, all those little things you think about in your head. I miss that. I don't miss the grind of it. The everyday, whether you win, you get home at 1 o'clock in the morning, and you think you feel good, but you lay there in bed for another 2 hours, and then you get up and go to the rink at 7, or if you lose, you stew about it for 3 hours and get up and go try to fix it at 7 in the morning. So I don't miss that. I don't miss that grind at all right now. And some of the other things, with this other job, you get to open your mind to different things. And Todd Lewicki laughs at me. He goes, "You're learning the dark side now." And there's just a lot of the business of the game, the politics of the game, especially we're trying to, you get a new building built in downtown Seattle. There's a lot of regulations and permitting and things like that that come into play. And then, you know, the whole construction process, which is actually very, very intriguing to me. A long time ago in Hartford, I used to have my own construction company. So I've always been kind of, enjoyed building things like that. So all those things have been very intriguing to me that have kind of taken away any part of the coaching that I missed. I'm busy enough where I get to watch games with a smile on my face. I get to watch how miserable some of those coaches look out there.
Well, Dave, I want to thank you for joining us. And I only have one request. I've never asked you for much over the years, but I have a very emotional request for you. If all goes well and we have NHL hockey in Seattle in a couple of years. And that is there any way that the goal song could be the Brass Bonanza?
Well, I kind of do a little radio show here, and we were going to do a Brass Bonanza yesterday, a tribute to Joel. So people around here might know it. I don't know if we can bring it here, but it's amazing, you know. It's amazing how many Hartford Whaler fans there are out there still.
For
the,
sure,
the stuff that get sent with memorabilia that get signed and stuff, it's incredible how many people are just Hartford Whaler fans. And I've met a few of them in Washington here in Seattle. People from all different walks of life have come up or reached out to me and say, you know, I lived in Hartford in the mid-80s and loved the Whalers. And so I think I'd have a hard time convincing Todd to put the Brass Bonanza on there, but you never know.
Oh, that's great.
Wow, that sounds great. Well, now just before we let you go, I don't know if you remember, it was a few years ago in Phoenix, I came out and spent some time with you, and actually asked my input on your lineup and line combination. So if you see my resume come across your desk, that you will know exactly why that's coming there. But I just want you to keep that in mind as well, that I believe you were 1-0 with Burnside helping out with your lineup. So just. For the record,
we might have to get both of you in, and we'll have a mock draft just to see how we come out, and then we can look at it after the real draft and see how wrong you guys really were.
Well, I'm wrong all the time. Although I tell you, if you saw how Scotty did in our media fantasy hockey league, you would never want him to be even like miles close to your operation. Let me tell you.
Fair enough.
All right.
All right. Well, Dave Tippett, good luck to you, and thanks for dropping by Two Man Advantage. That was great.
My pleasure, guys, and we'll see you along the road or somewhere.
Right. Sounds good. It's going to be exciting. Thanks, Dave.
Thank you. Bye now.
All right, my friend, and I will give you full props for suggesting we have Dave Tippett on this week, and it turned out to be great. And I must admit, I'm a little bit surprised that his career path is as defined as he just suggested to us that it is, that he's not going to be going back and that he won't reappear as the head coach of the new team in Seattle, which I think a lot of us had sort of imagined, you know, given his long history as a coach, that would be, you know, how this would work out, but that's not going to happen that way. Are you surprised by that? Or?
Yeah, certainly a bit of news there from Dave Tippett. And I don't know if I'm surprised. I just wondered. I knew that he was trying to walk his way through what he thought that he should do with this organization as time went on. And you know, he's really used the past year since he's been there to get his feet wet, get to know Todd Lewicki, get to know what, makes sense for him. And I guess deep down, I always thought he might be the coach, and only because that's all we've known him as since, you know, other than his playing days. But remember that he did get a taste of management in Arizona at the very end, and maybe that sort of transferred over to some of the things he wants to do now. And so it is interesting. And so what it tells you, obviously, is that, unless he's going to be the GM himself, but it doesn't sound like it because he talked about hiring a GM. But he'll have a role, a very important role. There'll be a GM, there'll be a coach. So some big decisions, obviously, for Seattle moving forward.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's not, there are lots of teams who have that kind of model, right? I mean, in Toronto, obviously, with Brendan Shanahan, who, is a Hall of Fame player, but is above the day-to-day operation than with the general manager. Of course, Kyle Dubas doing that job in Toronto, and John Davidson in St. Louis with working so closely with Jarmo Kekäläinen as a GM with the Blue Jackets. And there are lots of those kinds of positions around. And it just, it strikes me that that is, it's interesting that that's, you know, it sounds like the kind of role that, that Dave Tippett is going to move into. And it does set up all kinds of interesting possibilities about a first GM and of course, a first coach. And I thought your question about Joel Quenneville, of course, given their long history as former teammates, but also obviously given Joel Quenneville's status as the number two all-time winningest coach of all. And we're going to talk to Chicago writer Mark Lazarus about all that's unfolded in Chicago. But yeah, it certainly sets up some interesting dynamics moving forward. And you will be in coastal Georgia, where we expect in early December that the NHL will finalize team number 32 in Seattle. What are you looking forward to about that?
Well, I'm hoping that once, I mean, I think at this point it'd be pretty shocking if the Board of Governors voted no, but I guess you should never count your eggs. But once they vote yes, I'm hoping that the Board of Governors in the NHL will shed more light on the process moving forward. You know, they told us all along that the rules will be the same, but I do think on some level there might be some tweaks, you know, probably minor ones, but still stuff that I think hockey fans love to hear about. So I'm hoping that comes out of that meeting. And it's interesting, again, just to reinforce this before we move on from Seattle, but Dave Tippett reiterating what many of us had reported before, that if it looks like the team is indeed starting in 2020, that they want to follow the Vegas model in terms of a timeline for hiring a new GM, which is basically, 18 months out, right? So that would suggest a June hire this coming June of a new GM in Seattle, if indeed they're starting in 2020.
Right. Well, and that makes sense too. I mean, the off season is a time when the assistant GMs are able to talk to other teams. It's a period of time when there when there is going to be transition. That is the most logical time. For people to be looking elsewhere, and for teams to be looking to fill gaps in their own hierarchy. So it makes sense, and it should make for a very interesting and busy June 2019 for Dave Tippett if everything goes as planned.
Yeah, no, absolutely, and curious to see what title he ends up with. Right, that'll be now. Honestly, it really scares me that you offered your services. I mean, are you trying to sink Seattle before they even play a game?
And Dave and I have laughed about that just about every time we've crossed paths. And just before we, not to bore people, but I was doing sort of a day in the life with the coaching staff, and Sean Burke was on the staff at that point. Dave King was on the staff still at that point, and they were running through their line combinations, and at one point Dave Tippett did turn to me and he said, what should we do with Shane Doan? Because Shane Doan was in a bit of a slump, and I can't recall exactly what, but I suggested a line combination. They started, I believe they scored on their first shift, and certainly no one will be able to check, so I'm going to claim that they did, and they went on to a victory over, I believe it's the Minnesota Wild. So, but we have joked about it pretty much every time, but he did say, I don't want you to tell Shane Doan that you put that line together until enough time has elapsed that he won't get mad. So there you go. That's my story. So, all right, my friend. So, okay, don't go anywhere. I know you won't, because we're going to come right back with segment two of Two Man Advantage, and we're going to chat with our colleague and good friend, Mark Lazarus, in Chicago. All right, as promised, and as always, we return for segment two of Two Man Advantage, the podcast. And this is a great follow-up here. I'm very pleased. You suggested Dave Tippett join us. I reached out to Mark Lazarus, who is going to join us for the second segment today. And, of course, this is a very newsy podcast today. We're taping a day after the shocking announcement that Chicago Blackhawks have moved on from Joel Quenneville. And Mark, I thought your piece after the dust had settled very briefly was terrific. And I wonder if you can just sort of walk us through just your thoughts when you found out the news that the Blackhawks had decided to part ways with Joel Quenneville. Number two all-time in wins in NHL coaching, a surefire Hall of Famer at some point when he's done. Who knows when that is, but it's pretty dramatic news.
Yeah, I think what I wrote was it was unthinkable, but it was also inevitable. I mean, you know, Joel Quenneville is on the Mount Rushmore of Chicago coaches, up there with Phil Jackson and Mike Ditka and George Halas. He's probably, arguably, the greatest coach in the city's history. So just to see him fired mid-season, 15 games in, I mean, is inherently shocking. But he was almost fired in 2012, towards the end of that season. They were this close to firing him. He was almost fired again last season. I heard rumblings that they considered, even after giving him a vote of confidence at the end of the year, firing him over the summer. It seemed like they were just kind of looking for a reason to fire him at this point. You don't get fired 15 games into the season if this wasn't already sort of in the works. And, you know, the Blackhawks started out 6-2-2, kind of calmed everybody down. They go 0-4-1, come off a Western Canada road trip where Patrick Kane misses a game because he's sick. Duncan Keith misses 58 minutes of a game because he got ejected, probably unfairly. And, I mean, if you think about what happens in Calgary, Corey Crawford holds the fort down and they wind up winning that game. Does he not get fired now? You don't get fired because of a five-game stretch. So this clearly had been in the works for some time. And, you know, what I wrote is that, you know, this is part of a bigger power struggle between Stan Bowman, the general manager, and Joel Quenneville, the coach. They weren't at each other's throats. They didn't hate each other. It wasn't adversarial that much. But there's a push and a pull with any GM and coach, but particularly these two. And it dates back to that 2012 time when the Hawks lost 9 games in a row, this brutal stretch they were on, most of it on the road. They come back, and Stan Bowman puts Barry Smith, basically forces him on Joel Quenneville as an assistant coach to work on the power play. Joel Quenneville strongly resented this. I've heard from multiple sources that there was a bit of a shouting match that happened as a result of that. And there's been this lingering mistrust since. And the fact that Barry Smith is now an assistant coach for Jeremy Colliton, it certainly led me to believe, and many, many people I talked to told me this, that it was basically Stan and Scotty Bowman, they won the power struggle. That's office politics at work.
I don't even know how to follow that up. There's so much energy there.
I know, it's great.
It was like reading your column all over again. I was told yesterday, for what it's worth, and maybe it's because both guys are above anything, or above acting any other way, but I was told that the final meeting between Stan Bowman and Joel Quenneville was quite civil, actually, yesterday. But that doesn't take away from anything you just said, obviously, Laz. You're close to it, and I think you see a lot of people talking about, you know, that power struggle.
I think it's important to clarify that they're, like you said, their relationship was professional. They weren't at each other's throats. I didn't mean to paint it that way. Right. They were professional, but they had different visions in a lot of different ways. And you know, a guy like Joel Quenneville is not going to just sit there and be a yes man for his general manager, not with his resume. So I think it was natural that there was some of that friction.
But a couple of things I would say too, from a time zone away here. One is that, listen, I mean, they got, you know, as Scott said, I mean, the guy, Joel Quenneville, one of the greatest coaches ever, will be in the Hall of Fame one day. But 10 years is a long time. I mean, this is probably not a great comparison given everything you just painted. But, you know, Scotty Bowman left Buffalo, right? I mean, even the greatest of the great, Scotty Bowman, there is a term to everyone. And, you know, Claude Julien had a long run in Boston, another great coach. After a while, it's just time. And so I guess, to some degree, I was a bit surprised by the reaction on social media yesterday, only because, frankly, to your point, I thought this was going to happen late last season. And I was actually surprised it didn't. And again, not because Joel Quenneville deserves it, more because it's just, after a while, it's time. And wherever Joel Quenneville resurfaces, he's going to get on a great run again and have more success. But I think the idea that he should not have been fired mystifies me to some degree, I guess.
Well, it's interesting because I sat down with Joel in Calgary back in January, and it's my sixth year on the beat. It was the first time I actually had a one-on-one with Joel Quenneville. I don't know how he is with you national types, but he doesn't really do these kinds of interviews very often. And he kind of brought that up when we were just talking in general about the nature of the job and questions. And he said, you know, hey, does the message get stale? Do you need to change things up? He's like, I understand that. Everything in this business is a short-term business. I don't think Joel Quenneville, a lot of people were surprised by what happened. I don't think Joel Quenneville necessarily was. I don't think he wanted to get fired, but I don't think he was surprised.
That's sort of what I was getting at. And, you know, I put out a tweet yesterday, which I thought was rather obvious, but got a lot of reaction. But I kind of tied the LA Kings and Blackhawks together, given that, you know, they both made coaching changes within days of each other over the past week. And I just think it's sometimes it's the old forest from the trees thing, but you take a step back, you know, which is easier, I guess, you know, for me to do from my perch here. But it's fascinating to me the struggles that the Hawks and Kings have both had in almost identical ways since they won 5 cups in 6 years together. I mean, I think this system and the way that it does not allow you to hoard talent and to keep all your good players, no one's written the book yet on how to win a bunch of cups and then stay good. I think it's very difficult, and both teams are still trying to figure their way through that.
No question. Success in the NHL in a salary cap world comes at a severe cost. And after 2010, the Hawks had a purge. After 2013, they had a mini purge. After 2015, they had another purge. You just can't keep it going forever. And it's not the coach's fault that guys get older and slower. It's not necessarily the GM's fault either, but it's the GM's job to somehow maintain a successful roster. Mm-hmm. And I don't know what coach can come in right now and make this particular Blackhawks roster a Stanley Cup contender.
Mark, as you and I were chatting with Pierre just before we came back for the second segment, we had Dave Tippett talking about his role in Seattle, and of course a long connection between those two men, both as Western Conference adversaries, as coaches and teammates back in the day in Hartford. I think a lot of people immediately jump to, well, where does Joel Quenneville go next? And Pierre tweeted yesterday, he comes with a big ticket. He's being paid very well by one of the most successful franchises in the NHL. And I wonder if you think, when you think about what next for Joel Quenneville, is it something that happens quickly, or given his stature, given his salary, given perhaps what may be out there in terms of Seattle, that this is something that may not be something that happens overnight. Like I know Craig Cousins wrote a piece talking to Bruce Boudreau, who got fired in Washington and hired in Anaheim. I think it was 36 hours or 38, whatever it was. It was a matter of within 2 days, he was a head coach back in the NHL. And it's obviously worked out well for Bruce. But I wonder if you see a similar kind of arc for Joel Quenneville, or whether the dynamics may be quite different for him.
I think that's entirely up to Joel. I mean, if he wants a job right now, there's a few owners out there and GMs that would push their coach out the door right now to hire Joel Quenneville. Like, I mean, you look at it, a team like St. Louis, Mike Yeo has been on the hot seat for a while now. And Joel Quenneville has a history there. He's the one that got away, if you're a Blues fan. But like you said, he comes at a high price, and the Blues are a budget team. He's got a lot of money left on, it's got 2 years and a lot of money left on his contract. You know, the Hawks aren't going to just pay that and let him walk. They're going to have to want some compensation there. I don't know if that works. Maybe if Randy Carlyle's in trouble in Anaheim, would that be appealing? Or does Joel want to just sit down on the couch for the next 2 years, collect $12 million, and then try something different and new in Seattle? I think that'd be a fascinating challenge. If you've coached for 2 decades and you've won everything you can win, maybe you want to try something completely different, and maybe Seattle would be appealing to him. Joel, to my knowledge, has not spoken publicly yet about this. I know he hasn't gotten back to me, so I don't know exactly what he's thinking, but it's entirely up to him. If Joel Quenneville wants a job tomorrow, he'll have a job tomorrow.
Yeah, my sense is I think he's told a few people that he wants to take his time. But again, I'll tell you what's interesting about that, Mark, is that Claude Julien told people close to him after he got fired in Boston. Again, very similar, right? I mean, the Bruins, a long stretch in Boston for Claude Julien, including a Stanley Cup. And so Julien thought he was going to take time with family. He was getting paid well by the Bruins and just wait at least till the summer. But then the Montreal Canadiens called a week later.
and how do you say no?
And how do you say no to the job that would certainly matter the most to Claude Julien the second time for him? Now, I talked about this on Insider Trading on TSN last night, Mark, but the offset provision that exists for coaching hires. And it's never been more fascinating, probably in the history of the NHL, than it is right now when it comes to Joel Quenneville. As for people listening, the offset rule, which was put in years ago, but basically when you're still under contract with the team that fired you and then a new team hires you, the two teams have to balance the books together. So usually it's not a big deal. I mean, if the coach makes $2 million, usually he actually gets a raise in his new gig. So the team that fired him is happy to see him go. But sometimes, like John Tortorella, actually the Canucks and the Blue Jackets had, if you guys remember, had to kind of negotiate who would pay what. But they ended up finding a solution. And so the Canucks paid for a chunk of the rest of Tortorella's deal while he became coach in Columbus. But never has there been an an unemployed coach making $6 billion a year in NHL history. So
For two more years.
So I'm fascinated. I mean, you covered that team. Obviously, money's not an object with the Blackhawks, but I can't imagine, because there aren't that many teams in NHL that can pay $6 million. I know that, you know, the coaches' salaries have exploded, but at the end of the day, I still think only probably a third, if not fewer than that, can pay that kind of money. So if a team wants to hire Joel Quenneville and Joel Quenneville wants to go to that team, but they're only willing to pay $3 million, that puts the Hawks in a real interesting position for me. I mean, on the one hand, you want to treat Joel Quenneville with respect, given his legacy in Chicago and everything he's done, but you're also running a business. I mean, could you see them be willing to eat half of that?
I mean, eating half of it's better than eating all of it, right? I mean, it's kind of a risk management thing for them. Do they think that there's going to be a better offer out there, that a team will be willing to pay more of that? A team like Philadelphia has deeper pockets than a team like St. Louis. Do they hold out and wait for a better job themselves? I don't know how you approach that. Rocky Wirtz has very deep pockets. The liquor industry is very profitable in Chicago. And I don't get a sense yet for what they want. I don't think they want to be paying him $12 million to do nothing. I think they'd rather pay less and kind of get him off the books. Hey, I don't think that's good. Disrespectful.
By the way, it's good to know that I've made Rocky Wirtz rich from my trips to Chicago over the years.
You and a lot of other hockey writers.
And the other thing I shared yesterday, sorry, Scotty, is that, and this is more, it's not just related to Joel Quenneville, but really related to every successful coach or any coach, but that's had a long run. I really do hope he takes his time. It's easy for us to say on the sidelines because we have a job and, you know, we're not sitting at home doing nothing. But I think of the time that John Tortorella went straight from the Rangers job to the Canucks. And I don't think he was ready yet mentally for that. And I really, we're in an era where, thank goodness, we talk more about this stuff and we're more open about, you know, the stresses in their life and the mental stress. And I honestly think that after an amazing run in Chicago, that it would actually benefit Joel Quenneville to take the rest of the year off, in my opinion.
Yeah, it'll be interesting. I mean, the thing about Joel Quenneville, I feel like we think he's so old because he's been around for so long. He's 60. That's not that old in the hockey coaching world. He's got a lot of years ahead of him. So if he wants to take a year or two off, he can do that and still have plenty of good years ahead of him. He could just spend his time in Denver skiing. That's his favorite thing to do anyway.
Mark, I wanted to ask you sort of the opposite side of this coin. Is a relative unknown who comes in to take the place of Joel Quenneville? For Jeremy Colin, it at 33 years old, almost half the age of the guy he's replacing. You talk about big shoes to fill and all those kinds of dynamics. But I wonder, and I thought your piece earlier this week, even before the coaching change, about what to make of this Chicago team. You know, as you mentioned, really probably a surprising start on the positive side, hit a pretty flat spell. Maybe they're where a lot of us imagined them to be, sort of, you know, a middle of the road team, maybe slightly below middle of the road. Do you see, what's Jeremy Colliton's biggest challenge now coming in, trying to keep this team afloat and a team that, whose Stanley Cup window may have in fact closed, but are they still a team capable of making the playoffs? All those issues now, what's his biggest challenge, do you think, as he steps behind the bench as a first-time NHL head coach?
Well, I'm writing today about the fact that he's 33 years old and trying to command respect in a room with, 20-something Stanley Cups between everybody. There's four guys in the team older than he is. But I don't think that's going to be the biggest concern. I think he'll be quick to get respect. People like him. He's a former player. He's very good with open communication. I think he'll be fine in that regard. The trick right now with the Blackhawks is finding a direction. What are they? What are they trying to do? They've got this core that's not that old. Jonathan Toews just turned 30. Patrick Kane turns 30 in a couple of weeks. Duncan Keith is 35, but is basically endlessly young. Brent Seabrook's 33, declining maybe a little bit, but he's still got some years ahead of him. But then you've also got this next wave of prospects, this great blue line prospects, Adam Boqvist, Nicholas Bodin, Ian Mitchell. You got Joki Haru this year that in like maybe 2 years is ready to kind of take that mantle. What are you doing in these 2 years in the interim? That was my criticism of Stan Bowman, is that there's no forward motion here. There's no identity. They're not rebuilding. John McDonough, the team president, called it a remodeling. I don't know exactly what that means because they're just kind of running in place. They went out and they signed Brandon Manning and Chris Kunitz. How is that going to make you better or younger or faster? Or what are you? I don't know what they're doing. They're just kind of hanging in there. They want to stay competitive enough that they can still be relevant in Chicago, maybe squeak into the playoffs. But they're not rebuilding towards something, and they're not trying to win right now. So that's the trick. If you're Jeremy Colliton and you're trying to prove yourself at 33 years old, what can you do with this group right now? Who can come in right now and make this a contending team? I just don't see it.
Well, is it an untenable situation then, or are there things that you think he can bring to the table that maybe helps that younger group accelerate their evolution? Maybe he's familiar, obviously, with the players that would have been in Rockford. Is there a reason for optimism that at least in the short term, and we're talking this season, that there are some things that he can do that can vault this team back into the playoffs after missing last year and being swept by Nashville in the first round the year before?
It's possible. I mean, you talk to the guys, like I talked today to like guys like Alexander 14 and Eric Gustafson, Luke Johnson, who played for him in Rockford, and they love him. They say he's great at individually kind of, specializing his coaching for each individual player and making them better. So that can certainly help. Joel Quenneville, he's not going to take Luke Johnson aside for a half hour and sit him down one-on-one and talk him through some things. So that could certainly help. What could really help, though, is I think that the firing of Joel Quenneville, it wasn't waving the white flag. That would be way too dramatic to say, but it's kind of an admission, perhaps, that the expectations have to change a little bit around here for a couple of years. So maybe Jeremy Colliton won't quite have the pressure to win right now that you naturally have when you have Joel Quenneville leading Jonathan Toews and Patrick Kane and Duncan Keith and all these players. So maybe that'll help. Maybe ease some of that burden. The young guys can feel like, Like Kane and Toews did when they were young, when there was no expectations that they could just go out and make mistakes and learn to become NHL players. They benefited from playing in front of 5,000 people their first year at the United Center. It's a lot harder to be a rookie for the Blackhawks now than it was 11 years ago. So maybe all of that can help. And Colliton, I mean, Jeremy Colliton was always going to become the Blackhawks' next coach. The management loves him. Everyone raves about him. I don't think they expected it to happen this fast with 1 year of pro coaching experience in North America. But there's a reason that he's the coach right now. They believe in him. They think that he can become something special. What he does with his next 2 years is going to be very interesting because this team should be good again relatively soon. Kind of like what you saw with Boston, where they kind of had that retooling on the fly after a couple of down years. Pittsburgh went through a couple of down years, maybe not quite this down, but you can do that. Or do you become the Kings, where you just become obsolete so quickly that your head spins? That's going to fall on Jeremy Colliton to see if he can kind of tinker and adjust and teach and coach and make these guys just better enough that they can hang in until that next wave comes in.
Well, I think the key obviously is, and then pointing out the obvious, is drafting and developing, but it's huge. And, you mentioned Pittsburgh. They really, other than a very small blip, have essentially been competitive / a contender for almost 13 years, which is crazy to think about. I mean, between the Ray Shero era and the Jim Rutherford era, there was certainly a blip in between, which cost Ray Shero his job, but they really never bottomed out, and they won 3 championships, and they're still a good team. But the key is that they've produced a lot of homegrown players. And, this is where I think the Kings have struggled the last 5 years. I don't think myself that they draft as well as they used to. Whereas I do think the Blackhawks have done a better job of drafting than the Kings. We need Scott Powers on here to bring us up to speed on all the prospects in the Hawks system. But is it good enough? I mean, I think of a team that actually hasn't won a cup under Steve Yzerman, but has been knocking at the door forever in Tampa Bay. Not only have they been one of the better teams in the league the last 5 years, but I was talking to someone the other day who had unbelievable knowledge of the AHL, and they said, you wouldn't believe who they have in Syracuse. And the point being that, Tampa's got some staying power here past the next couple of years because of what they have coming. And that's the key. I mean, that's the hardest part of it all.
And yeah, but you look at what the Blackhawks are farther down that path, I think. They had 10 solid years nine years, I guess it would be, of just utter dominance, really. They had a couple of first-round losses thrown in, but, you know, Western Conference Final in 2009, Stanley Cup in 2010, Stanley Cup in 2013, overtime of Game 7 of the Western Conference Final in 2014, Cup in 2015. I mean, maybe you wrung as much out of this as you can, and is that so bad? Wouldn't you pay that price to have a couple of down years now in the late 2010s to have that kind of run of success? I don't think any Blackhawks fan or management or anybody can look at what the Blackhawks have done and said, man, they blew it. They really screwed like in Chicago, people still talk about the 1985 Bears. Man, they should have won three or four Super Bowls. I don't think you can have that kind of regret with the Blackhawks.
No, it's been an unbelievable run. And you know, I know this has been, it's been popular to run down Stan Bowman this week because of the firing of Joel Quenneville, but Stan Bowman's done an unbelievable job having to rejig three different, you know, the last two cup rosters from the first one, as you know, Mark. And you know, I think the trade that I think antagonizes a lot of Hawks fans is Artemi Panarin, given that he truly is one of the great goal scorers in the world. But, and I think you know this, obviously you've written about it, I think the Hawks thought that what is happening now to Columbus with Panarin was going to happen to them.
Absolutely. Stan's talked about it a lot, yeah.
Right. And so he criticized all he wanted, and maybe at the end of the day, it should have been someone else instead of Brandon Saad. Who knows? I think it's too early to say that Brandon Saad isn't going to go back to being the player he can be. I think there's still time. But at the end of the day, it's absolutely understandable why the Hawks thought, you know what, a year from now, we're going to have our hands full trying to convince Panarin to sign an extension when you're out. Or, even if he wants to sign, can we afford him under our cap? So maybe it's not quite like Columbus, where he clearly just doesn't want to sign at all. But, okay, Panarin says, yeah, I'll sign. I'll take $11 million a year. Well, that's not going to work in Chicago. So, I mean, that's a trade that I defend Stan Bowman on, because if you were in his shoes, a worse outcome it would be sitting where Columbus is right now, where they cannot sign Panarin, and it certainly looks like they can't, and are either going to have to trade him when they're potentially in a playoff spot this season, or let him walk out for free on July 1st. It's a horrible position to be in.
Yeah, I mean, I was an advocate of that trade. I thought it was a great trade at the time, because Brandon Saad is a better all-around player than Artemi Panarin. You got what you thought was going to be a good backup goalie in Anton Forsberg. It just hasn't worked out. That trade is not an egregious crime by Stan Bowman. The question is, would you have rather stuck with Hjalmarsson and Panarin for two more years, tried to squeeze one more cup out of this this core? Would that have been better off than what's happened the last years, just to get some cost certainty? Now, Hjalmarsson's not the player he once was. Forsberg didn't work out. I mean, there's a million what ifs that you can go through. But, you know, Stan Bowman was playing the long game, and that's his job, is to think about not just next year, but 4 years down the road. And you're right, Stan did a very good job. You know, people criticize him, which isn't really fair, for taking over Dale Talon's core, but they lost half that team in 2010, and he got two more cups out of that. That's not nothing. That's a really good job that he did. But the last 3 or 4 years, he has had way more misses than hits. You have to talk about the Brent Seabrook contract, which is kind of an albatross around the Hawks' neck right now. He signed for 6.5 more years. You have to talk about, you know, guys that they've let walk, guys that they've traded away, the Phil Deneau trade, that, you know, giving Teuvo Teravainen away just to get rid of a year of Brian Bickell's contract. Hell, Vinny Hinostroza would look good right now in the bottom six. The Hawks have no depth scoring, but they traded him away, even though they could have theoretically just kept Marian Hossa on long-term injured reserve. There's been a lot of misses lately. I think it's fair to criticize him, but that doesn't diminish what he accomplished in the past by any means.
Yeah. Mark, no question. You mentioned early on talking about, you know, when Patrick Kane and Jonathan Toews first came in the NHL, it was a time when the Blackhawks were, you know, whether if they weren't irrelevant entirely, they were irrelevant. Yeah. Right. And I remember, you know, as a reporter coming from Toronto and doing a story about how the Chicago Wolves were outdrawing the Chicago Blackhawks on a regular basis. And I wonder if you have some perspective on, you know, there's a whole, I don't know whether a full generation, but certainly hundreds of thousands of Hawks fans who know only success or the growth towards success with young Toews and Kane and building up to the first cup in 2010. Is there a danger when you have some lean times that goodwill, that standing in the sports community in Chicago, that it erodes? Or is this team solid regardless of what happens in the next 2 or 3 or 4 years? Or what's, you know, how precarious is having built yourself to the top of the mountain in that city? How precarious is that hold?
That's the big question, and it's a concern. John McDonough has told me it's a concern. I mean, the Bears are getting good again. The Cubs are on top of the world. The Hawks don't have this town in the palm of their hand the way they did just a few years ago when they were by far the best franchise in town, and they were the cool team, the young team, the one that everybody wanted to be a part of. It's a fine line between a bandwagon fan and a new fan. I don't think that the Blackhawks have a tremendous deep young fan base. I mean, they interact with the people on Twitter. That's the young fan base. They do better than the Bears do and the Cubs do in attracting that young market. But you're right. They have never faced any real adversity as a fan. Their adversity was, you know, in 2012 when they lost to Arizona in the first round. Oh no. So they haven't been tested yet. And we don't know if they're going to stick around. I think most of them will. I mean, when you interact with these people, I do on a daily basis, they are obsessive fans. Just because they're new doesn't make them good fans. I always say every fan has an origin story. And just because you were a bandwagon fan in 2009 doesn't mean you're a bad fan in 2018. These are fans that jumped on board on that bandwagon and got hooked. And now they're arguing about who's on the left wing on the fourth line and why the power play, the 1-3-1, is a bad structure for this particular team. These have become good, knowledgeable fans. Now, will they stick around? That's the $64,000 question in Chicago. If you have a few lean years here, you know, the Blackhawks sellout streak is about to end because tickets are catastrophically expensive. And if the team's not great, it's going to be tough to sell a 22,000-seat building. But I don't think they're going to there's no danger of them slipping back into the kind of irrelevance they had when Bill Wirtz wouldn't put home games on TV. And that was unbelievably just 12 years ago. They have a good foothold now, but they are going to fall behind the Cubs and the Bears. They already have. And they could fall behind the Bulls, who are building a young team. The White Sox are rebuilding. It's hockey. When it comes down to it, when you're the hockey team in a major market, you're always the underdog. And if they are mediocre for a while or worse than mediocre, they're going to be, you know, playing in front of 12 or 13,000 fans and TV ratings are going to go down. That's just inevitable. That happens in just about every market.
Well, not where I live, but
they know is lean years in Toronto.
So. Yeah, I was going to say the hockey team is never behind anyone anywhere in Canada. But I was going to mention to you, Laz, that I can't believe you guys have been sleeping on the story in Chicago the last few years. You know that people have discovered in Toronto that the salary cap is unfair.
Oh my God, is it? I've never heard that before. I thought it was okay that you develop and protect your own talent and then have to trade them away. Everybody's so cool with that in Chicago.
The rules are all going to change now because the Leafs are affected.
I bet they are. You're going to start seeing like those bird exemptions and all the NBA stuff where your own talent. That's what happens is once Toronto gets upset, things actually change.
All right, my friend. Well, this has been a banner event for Two Man Advantage, the podcast. So, Mark Lazarus, thanks for coming and hanging out with us for a while. And it's going to be a fascinating, I was doing the math in my head, but let's call it 65 games or whatever left for the Blackhawks. And it's going to be fascinating to see how it unfolds. And let's do this again as we move along. But thanks for coming and hanging out with Pierre and I.
Yeah, it was fun. I never get to see you guys anymore because I don't cover any playoff teams anymore.
Ouch, wow.
Well, that who knows? That might be the great story by the end of this year with a 33-year-old coach.
My first 3 years in the beat, I covered 12 playoff rounds, and then the next three, I've covered two.
So you're what you're saying is you've got a good reserve of energy.
I'm rested. Let's go.
All right. All right, Laz, thank you for hanging out.
Anytime, guys.
All right, my friend, that was great. I feel really energized by this episode today. What's your in your heart of hearts? I mean, I thought a year ago that when people were saying it was, you know, the window had closed on the Blackhawks, I thought it was premature. I thought they were a team that was probably still going to sneak into the playoffs. Obviously, it didn't happen. And what's your gut tell you? Does the coaching change energize them? Are they a team that can find their way into the top eight? Or is this really the start of, you know, call it a rebuild or whatever you want to call it, but this is really a signal that things are going to change for the next couple of years in Chicago.
you know, maybe if they were in the Pacific, I'd say they had some hope. But I just think being in the Central Division, it's just going to be too difficult. I think what it allows, though, now, and again, they'll never duplicate the amazing run that Joel Quenneville gave them, probably, but they certainly have a chance to try to get there again one day. But I think what it allows the Hawks to do now with a young coach is to make a lot more long-term decisions and try things that are more about the future than just now. And I know that John McDonough at his news conference talked about the need to be competitive now as well, but sometimes I think you have to say things publicly because you're running a business and you have to sell tickets. But I think if they allow Stan Bowman to do some of the things that I believe he's capable of, I think there's a chance to turn this around in not that long a period. But certainly I think there has to be more pain here before that happens.
Yeah, I think you are probably right. One thing, though, it's always no pain here at Two Man Advantage, the podcast, but it is time to bid adieu for this week, and we'll do it again next week as always. But good work today, my friend. You're on top of your game.
And I'm no longer asking you for Zeke Elliott because I made my big trade today, so I'm done.
I was waiting for you to ask. Now no one wants him because the Cowboys are terrible. We waited too long.
They'll probably beat the Eagles Sunday night just for the heck of it.
All right, my friend. Well, we'll chat again next week.
Sounds good.